Ben Baskin are interviewing Mr. Donald Robinson on Friday, January 27, 1978, in the executive suite of Maxon Towers apartment on one of the coldest days in Pittsburgh history. Donald, as president of the Joint Distribution Committee, we would like to have you tell us a little about your early background.
Do you want me to start?
Yes.
From when? From when I was a child?
Yeah, you were a child.
You were born in Pittsburgh.
Well, I think I had the usual Jewish upbringing when we were in modest circumstances, a family. And we lived in Squirrel Hill, moved around a few times, and I think that was probably the average experience. Went to Colfax, and then on to Taylor Alderdice. And was bar mitzvahed at the Pol Zedek, which was, as you know, an Orthodox synagogue. And I really don't remember too much about more than that, you know, except that the Second World War had a great impact on all of us when in high school.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many children were there in the family?
There were three brothers.
Were you the oldest?
No, I'm the middle one.
And what was Dad's name?
Alex.
And Mother?
Leona. Okay.
And what did they do at the time when you matriculated from high school? What?
Well, my dad was in the wholesale tobacco and candy business. And he was located on Penn Avenue in the wholesale district at a relatively small operation. And it was almost wiped out by the 36th flood. I remember that very well, but it completely flooded out. I remember going down after, as soon as we could, and trying to help clean up. What a mess that was.
What year was that flood? That
36.
Was the big Pittsburgh flood of 36.
36. I was 11 years old at the time.
So you graduated Taylor Alderdice High School?
43.
In 43.
And right.
And then?
Well,
were you active in school activities? Did you
somewhat, but not exceptionally. I wasn't the president of the class or anything like that. Far from it. When I, in the last year in school, I took the Navy came in the Army because everybody thought in terms of service, and I took the test for the B-12 program, the Navy B-12 program. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I was accepted in that program. And so when I graduated in June, they sent me to Bethany, West Virginia for two semesters to college there. Okay. A lot of my friends went into the Army program, which was supposed to be similar to the Navy program. But what happened was, unfortunately, when the Army, during the Battle of the Bulge, when they needed young men quickly, they disbanded their program, their college training program, and took all the boys overseas. In fact, some of my friends were killed at that time.
Hmm.
Now, okay.
Now, as far as a Jewish atmosphere in your home, holidays, activities?
Yeah, we maintained, a Jewish home. My parents weren't ultra-Orthodox or anything like that, but we did belong to the Pol Zedek for many years, I think because my mother's father belonged there. He was a Rong, Morris Rong, and perhaps you remember the Rong, and they were in the wholesale grocery business.
But you observed the holidays.
Oh,
you
yes.
were all bar mitzvah. You had a traditional home.
Yeah, that's right.
Was your father born in the United States?
No, he was born in Lithuania. Okay. You want me to tell you a little bit about my service career?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Well, when I went in, I was 17, when I went into the Navy. And as I said, I was very fortunate to get into this B-12 program. I didn't think I was so fortunate at the time, because all of us wanted to get over and fight the Germans. You know, you knew the patriotic fervor at that time. It's completely different than we have today, or that we had during the Vietnam War.
No.
So when I went into Bethany, after two semesters there, they transferred me to what they call their NROTC, which is their Naval Reserve Officers Training Program. And they sent me to the University of South Carolina. And it was an accelerated course, which in 1945 I graduated there and received my Bachelor of Science degree. And as I graduated, the war was just ending. So along with a good friend of mine, we decided that we should start thinking about our future career. And we requested Navy Supply School, which was at the Harvard Graduate School of Business. They had taken it over for the Navy during the war. And we both got into that particular program and went to Harvard Graduate School. Still in service, and I took the course there, which was an accelerated business-oriented course for supply, for naval supply, and I graduated from there, and then I requested and got a troop transport, and I became the dispersing officer on a troop transport and made about four or five trips to Europe and back.
What year was this?
This was in 46, and we were bringing the boys back at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But don't forget, I was 21. I was completely finished with my schooling and had my commission. And it really gave me a tremendous sense of responsibility. I would say if anything shaped my life, if it had to be the Navy, it had a tremendous impact on mm-hmm. it. Well, because, first of all, I went in when I was 17,
yes.
And they taught me discipline. And they taught me how to be in command and how to relate to people. And I had, as an example, on the ship I was on, I was the S Division officer, which was the Supply Division officer. And I'm 21 years old, but I had all these stewards, and they were all black at that time. They were all had to report to me, so to speak. It was a very, very good experience.
Well, 21, yes.
Yeah. So I never regretted it. I think that it was, without question, one of the great, great strokes of luck in my life that I got my education. When I came back, I got out in the latter part of 46. All of my friends were coming back, and they had to go to college yet. So I was all finished with college and graduate school in business. So
now, when you came back, did you move back into the home with your father and mother?
Yes. Yes, I moved back. And we lived on Beechwood Boulevard. My folks had bought a home on 2835, I think, Beechwood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's up in the St. Paulina's area.
Yes.
Yeah, Sylvia lived five doors away, right.
Now, who was Sylvia?
Sylvia was Sylvia Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother, Morty, and my younger brother used to play together, but I never knew Sylvia.
The girl next door.
No, I married the boy next door.
And she was to become your wife. Do you want to tell us a little about your courtship, Donna?
Well, she first, when I came home on leave one time from service, after I had had my commission, we crashed a wedding at the Webster Hall. You know, that was fun those days, right? And then that's where I first met Sylvia. And I was in my uniform, so she was captivated.
In what year was that?
Well, it had to be 46, probably. Or the latter part of 45 or 46.
Mm-hmm.
I had come home from, I was at Harvard at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started dating a little bit. And then we corresponded. I started going over to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So we corresponded. She said I wrote letters like... They weren't very warm, but by 1947 we were married.
And where were you married?
At the William Penn, in the room with all the mirrors.
Yeah, the urban room.
The urban room?
Yeah.
By a rabbi?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember the rabbi? From the Paul Ascetic Shepherd?
No, it was from the Beth Shalom. Who was the rabbi before Goldblum? Rose. I think it was Rabbi Rose. In fact, I think he got my name wrong. I'm not quite sure. be married Donald Miller to Sylvia Miller or something like that.
Oh, my.
That's very interesting. Might not be married at all.
And where did you move from there?
We took an apartment in the Ruth Gardens at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the Ruth Gardens, it's still here.
And you went into the family business?
That's correct. Right.
Will you tell us a little about that?
Okay. Well, as I said, my dad had a wholesale tobacco and candy business, but it was a relatively small business. We were down in Penn Avenue. Mm-hmm. Doing a small business with the retail grocers and confectionery store owners and that type. So my brother Bud and myself started to go out on the road to create outside business because we had nothing but walk-in business. And from 1946 until 1949, we were working very hard to build up the business on the road. In 1949 or 1950, I heard about this rack-jobbing concept, which was where supermarkets were putting in health and beauty aids. So I decided to find out more about it, and I went to California. I made a trip to California because they're always were ahead of us in the supermarket industry. And at the same time, don't forget, we were selling some of these items to the smaller grocery stores. The country stores and the grocery stores always traditionally handled toothpaste and shampoo and so forth, but the big supermarkets never did. They just didn't bother with it. And when I came back, we all agreed that it was pretty something that we should get into. So I went to Thoroughfare, to L.B. Smith, Sr., who has passed away, but he was the president of Thoroughfare, and I'll never forget, he was sitting at an old wooden desk, and he would read his mail and throw it over his shoulder. He was that kind of character, but he was a merchandising genius. And he was very gruff, but he said, well, we'll try it. So, okay, I'll put it away. Yeah. So, he gave us a couple stores to test for, and we had to run out and get racks and devise a system and so forth, and we did. And they were successful, and then we went to Donahoe's. You remember Donahoe's?
Oh, of course. Right.
Okay. And I remember going up, it's interesting, I went upstairs to Pete and John Donahoe. They were in the building that 15 or 20 years later we bought.
Oh, in downtown Pittsburgh on Fifth Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they were very nice. And they gave us, they were a factor in the supermarket business at that time. Unfortunately, they weren't able to control it, and they lost out. But they gave us some stores. And Thoroughfare liked the business, so by 1950, we were really gearing up into this rack-jobbing business. And we built a new building up in the 2700 block of Penn Avenue, because we just couldn't handle it. We did it, you know, we had to borrow up to our eyeballs at the banks and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided to make the big move, which was we got out of the wholesale tobacco and candy business altogether, so we could free up some capital for this rack jobbing business. Which we're doing. Listen, if I'm taking too long on this.
No, stuff, that's all right. Very honest.
Then we went to A&P, and A&P at that time was a dominant chain in the East, and especially in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed tremendously in the grocery business, but.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You have to realize at the time A&P was a very, very big factor in the grocery business. We convinced them that they should handle health and beauty aids, and they gave us some stores on a test basis again. And they liked it so well that we went back and they said, listen, we want to do this thing, but you know, we like to do things in a big way, and we can't give you a contract. But if you're interested, you can have our business. And so we made a deal with them to not only have all of their Pittsburgh business, but we took their Philadelphia division in the Richmond, Virginia division. And we really gambled because they wouldn't give us any kind of guarantee or contract. But we ended up with, inside of 2 years, we'd opened about 1,500 A&P stores. It's a tremendous expansion for us.
1,500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so by 1953-54, we had built our business up to, I guess we were doing about $15-18 million for that time.
What was the name of your company?
A. Robinson and Sons.
Dad was the president?
He was chairman of the board, I was the president.
Was it a privately held company?
Privately, yeah. And we had an excellent relationship with all of these people, including AMP. We did a very good job for them, and we made money. You know, that helped. That really made us create the kind of capital we needed. But at the same time, they made money, and they were appreciative of the kind of expertise and the knowledge they got from us. So, but they always said to us, you know, we're going to take this thing over. It's only a matter of time. And but they gave us about 8 or 9 years.
So you knew that eventually.
Oh yeah, we knew eventually that a telephone call would put us out of business. With, you know,
yes.
They handled it in a very gentlemanly fashion. They gave 6 months or a year notice and so forth. So in the late 50s, they started to take the business back and handle it through the warehouse. And we had such a good relationship with them that we would actually help them set up their warehouses to handle this direct. Because that's the kind of people they were.
Mm-hmm.
Then we decided, by this time, by the way, we had 6 or 7 branch warehouses. We had one in Richmond and one in Philadelphia and one in Youngstown. Wow. And we had one in Altoona and one in Fairmont, West Virginia. All to handle this business.
Mm-hmm.
Basically AMP, but we still had Thoroughfare and we had some independent stores and so forth. So that in the late 50s, we could see that we were losing our AMP business. And we started thinking and trying to devise another way of staying in business, and especially in the line we knew, which was health and beauty and toiletries. So then we decided to open our first White Cross store. And we did that in 1961.
Now, was that considered a drugstore? Or was it a beauty aid?
In people's mind, it was a drugstore.
But you didn't dispense prescriptions.
No, we did not. We did not. For many reasons. First of all, we wanted to move quickly in this business. And
where was your first store, Donald?
First store was in Erie, Pennsylvania. And we made a calculated decision at that time that we would, since we had always been like the middleman, that we would now become the retailer, and we would eliminate all the middleman profits. But we also decided that we would break the law by selling below fair trade. And there was a fair trade law at the time, which was ridiculous.
Yes.
And, you know.
I remember that Shaver.
Yeah. And so we opened in Erie, Pennsylvania, and it was a phenomenal success. And then we opened in Norfolk. This is back in 61. And again, it was a tremendous success. So we decided that we're ready to get out of the rack shopping business and go into the retail business. And we did. Within 2 years, the customers that we had left, like Thoroughfare, was still a very large customer of ours. We said to them that we're going to go out of this business and we'll help you get set up to handle it yourself, which we did. We taught them the business so that they could warehouse it. In the meantime, we're opening stores. We had the organization. We had the distribution centers, Richmond and Fairmont, West Virginia, and so forth. So we were opening stores like mad. Retail stores, White Cross. And then we started with our pharmacy operation, I guess it was in 63 or so. We started to gradually get into that.
Now, Donald, as your business grew,
tell
us a little bit about how your family with Sylvia grew.
Okay. Well, let's see. I think Steve was born in 1951. In fact, I remember the day he was born because I had a visit with one of the high AMP officials. And it was like a, you know, double luck. And Steve was born, and I remember he gave us a lot of stores at that time. And Carol was born, I guess it was around, she's 57, somewhere around there. I think she's 22 now.
How many children do you have?
2.
And did they go to college?
Yes.
Stephen?
They both finished at the University of Pittsburgh. Carol has a master's from Northwestern in advertising.
And Stephen?
Stephen is just, he has a BA.
Is he in the business today?
Steve is a stockbroker.
Oh. Are the children married?
No.
Good. Living at home?
No.
Out on their own like their father was at the age of 17.
Sure. Well, they don't live at home.
No.
I don't know, unless there's something wrong with them. They live with their friends now, you know that.
Of course. It's 1978.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, at what point did you start taking an active interest in the Jewish community?
In 1959, when we were phasing out of the rag chopping business, I started to develop some time in this period. So I remember going down and talking to Herman Feinberg and Bob Hiller.
Remember? Sure do.
Good old Herman. He's always been my mentor, one of my mentors anyway.
We did his interview back.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a very
and
great
I remember
guy.
Bob Hiller.
And I told him that I had some time and I would like to be more involved and interested in Jewish affairs. I think I had just read Exodus. And, you know, it comes at a certain time in your life when you feel that you should be doing something other than business. And so they arranged for Sylvia and I to go with the UJA study mission to Israel. First we went to Europe and then to Israel.
And what year was this? Did we have
1959. And that was probably the turning point as far as I was concerned, getting involved in especially the Jewish affairs.
And so early, the infancy of Israel in 59.
Well, 59 was not quite the infancy.
But, yeah, but the beginning.
Things were, you know, a lot different than they are today, no question about it. So then in 61, we went with the Pittsburgh mission, which was, again, we went back to Israel in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And I got very busy with White Cross in the early 60s. I wasn't doing a lot of community work. I was on the Board of Federation and taking some cards in the campaign and that kind of thing. But in 67, Al Rogel was president and he asked me to be campaign chairman, which I did. And that was the year of the war. And then in 68, I was campaign chairman.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to continue with
whatever.
Well, and then in 1971, well, it was actually 1970 when I became president.
President of
the Federation. I was president in 71, 72, and 73.
You had your work cut out for you.
Yeah, it's 73. Now, I didn't finish the business, but I don't care.
You
can just leave the discussion any way you want.
Now, as you became more involved in community affairs, Sylvia was a wonderful helpmate. She went right along with you.
Yes, I would say so. But, you know, Sylvia's a little more shy than I am. But, so it's taken her, I guess, a little bit longer to get involved. It was easier for me, I'll put it to you that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being in business and everything, you have to be more aggressive than I guess. Her heart is in the right place.
It certainly is. She's made a marvelous commitment, too, to the city of Pittsburgh.
Now, while you were active in your community activities, White Cross was also growing, and you were thinking of bigger things than that.
Well, White Cross, we in the early 60s were very busy with White Cross, and we went from zero stores in 61 to in 1965 when we went public. I think we had about 60 stores. And we went public in 1965, and we went on the American Stock Exchange in 66 and the New York Stock Exchange in 1967. And then we merged with Revco in 1972. We had 180 stores, something like that, doing close to $100 million.
Now, was Dad still in the business at this time?
Yeah, he's always been in the business.
And your two brothers?
Yeah. We also were in had an orange grove operation in Florida, which we started back in 1960 also. And Dad would manage that in the winter. He went to Florida. I don't blame him. And then he would manage that. That kept him very busy. And he enjoyed it very much.
And you still have the orange groves?
No, we sold it about a year and a half ago. we may go back in that one. I always enjoyed it.
Now, Donald, you were the president of White Cross, is that right?
That's correct.
So as the business grew and things might have gotten a little easier, you didn't have to be out on the road drumming as you did at the very beginning.
Right.
Tell us more then about your involvement with the...
Well, in addition to his activities here, he also took on various other volunteer jobs with the Symphony Society, the Art Committee of Carnegie Institute.
Well, I've been involved with the Symphony Society for a long time. I guess about 12 years. Does it say when I started on the board there? I don't know.
Yes, 1973 to the present.
No, 66.
Oh, no.
66.
66? Yes. I said 12 years. Huh? Yes. Right. I've been involved with the Symphony. I enjoy it. We've always gone. And I started on the board in 66. And then in, I guess it was 71 or 72, right around there, they asked me to be chairman of the investment committee and a vice president. So I assumed that role.
To the present day?
To the present day. I'm still chairman of the investment. We have an endowment portfolio of about $22 million.
You also took an active part at Montefiore Hospital.
Right. I've been involved off and on in the hospital, you know, as a board member or vice president. In fact, they renominated me as a vice president.
Good. Very good.
Very good. I really am not that active in the hospital. I mean, I do go to the meetings when I can, but I'm not... I've never been president or anything like that. It's just, I don't have enough time for it. I'd like to be more active, but I don't have enough time.
In addition to your travels to Israel, do you have to travel throughout the United States with your philanthropic activities?
Oh, yeah, I do an awful lot of traveling, more than I like. But I do.
Mm-hmm. How many times have you been to Israel this last year, in 77?
Three, and I'm going Monday. I'm averaging about three times a year in Israel.
I see.
But the last trip, to give you an idea, maybe I'm digressing here.
No, that's right.
We went to Israel, and we were supposed to be there about 4 or 5 days, and then we were going to France. But something developed in Romania. So we ended up 2 days in Israel, 2 days in Romania, 2 days in France, and 3 days in Geneva.
You're a good troubleshooter, Donald.
I don't know if that's a troubleshooter. That's the kind of schedule.
How did you first really become so interested in what must be your first love since you're the national president today of the Joint Distribution Committee?
Well, through my involvement in UJA and its events.